could. People are going to get the wrong impression.
I don't get that impression.
No, but actually, when I first started at age, Michael and you were my first teachers.
Oh, really?
Good to see you. Hi, Nigel. How are you?
Okay.
And that was so sweet of you to call to let me to remind me about that.
I said that last week too. I felt bad that I used to long ago when I was on top of.
I was already sitting here when I got the message, but.
Wow, you really were early.
I came like 40 minutes early.
The only negative thing.
I see.
Like the ice box.
It is a little chilly, even for me. You know, it's like which is unusual. I'm rarely cold.
Well, we already did Mark, so. They did Marv already. Do you know that?
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
Oh, so I missed Marv.
I don't understand why they did early today, but they did.
Did they stop the 9 o'clock Marv anymore?
I don't know. Yeah. Unless they're doing it again.
Oh, okay. Could be that. Maybe they have two Marvs. That's possible, too. Awesome. We need only eight more. Okay. I want to do a little bit of review for a couple of reasons. One is that not all of you have heard the last two Shiurim. And two is these three are really... one subject. And so even for those that have heard the past, I think it's important to hear again. My normal, this is not for the tape, but it's okay. My normal glasses are, as we age, we need prescription changes all the time. So they're being re-prescriptionized. And so these are just reading glasses, which means that I have to do this a lot. You know, if I squint a lot, it's not because there's anything painful about seeing you. It's because I can't see. You're all fuzzy. There, okay, that doesn't matter.
Those progressives?
My usual glasses are progressive. These are just reading.
Oh.
So, therefore, this is all blurry. But this is great. Okay. Okay, I'm just not used to that sort of thing. All right. 2 weeks ago, we began this by stating that... Oh, before I go on, I may forget later on. I don't want to forget. There is no class next week. I have a special event. I'm turning 50, so...
Oh,
but if I don't jump off a bridge, then it'll be... No, I'm kidding. I'm just saying. No, we're going out. We're going out. Oh, thank you. Oh, sweet. Okay.
50 is the new
30. It is, really? Mm-hmm. Everyone's it's the hip age to be. Everyone's turning 50. Everyone who turns 50 says that.
No, it's like that's what you hear all the time.
Tracy just turned 2.
Okay. No, I'm fine, really. Okay. I just didn't want, I may forget, so I'll call everybody anyway. I just don't want you to come unnecessarily. Okay, we defined halacha 2 weeks ago as the laws of nature of the spiritual world. And we said that just as there are natural laws in the physical world, you know, pick this up, it's going to fall down, you know, boom. It's gravity, sun rises, sun sets, these things happen. Many, many laws, we take things for granted. And even things that are quote-unquote man-made, right, we have to operate them to function, to get ahead. Similarly, the spiritual world has laws, and we have to operate within those laws. There are different types of laws, certainly, and they're activated differently, but there are laws similarly, and that's how our soul functions. Okay, so the difference is they're metaphysical acts. Metaphysical meaning there's a physical component. We do something. We daven. We eat. We don't eat. We select something. Don't select something. Right? We make certain decisions. That's the physical part. Now, it's not only physical, it's verbal as well. We speak. We refrain from speaking to say certain things, right? We say something nice to someone, that's a mitzvah. We think, even thoughts. So all these are the... And then there's a metaphysical component. There's a component that the soul gains or shrinks or suffers somehow. Okay? So all that happens. These are all laws. We divided them into mitzvah, which for the purpose of the class in this series, the mitzvah is an obviously religious activity. Prayer being the example we wanted to use, but you can also say, hear a shofar, shake a lulav, okay, things that are very obvious, part and parcel of a Jewish experience. Then there is a mishpat, and then there's a chok, and We usually define those things. A mishpat is a law that makes sense. A chok is a law that doesn't inherently make sense. We define it differently in the sense that a chok is a black and white phenomenon. It either is kosher or is not kosher. And it doesn't matter how we feel about it. It doesn't matter if what day of the week it is. It doesn't matter what day of the year it is. Right? It's a hoax. Is a hoax. Shotness is shotness, and you know, if you wear shotness, that's an avera, and if you don't, then it's not an avera. It's very, very simple. There's no principle behind it. There are people, we said, that have given reasons. The Chinuch does a very good job of that. There's other books that define, give us secondary. Hirsch is a master at giving us, but those are all secondary reasons. Ultimately, a chok is the law of a natural law of the soul. Okay, we refrain from eating pork because eating pork is bad for our soul, and that's that. A mishpat is not like that. A mishpat, there is a principle involved. And in any given act will require an analysis of the context of that act. Okay, so forgive me for repeating, Jenny, but
I used your honor.
That happens when you know someone too. I think you're forgive me. So, for twice now. Forgive me for...
Please, don't.
Okay.
More than anyone need reviews.
Okay. So we use the example, it's an example in the Gemara, actually. So the Talmud has an example where a person puts his father to back-breaking work, doing crushing of seeds or something like that, orders him to do it. And the reason he orders him to do it is that, unbeknownst to the father, the Roman governor is coming to select people for the front lines of the army, and had his father not had a job at that point in time, the father would have been pulled out to the army. So the Gemara says that is an act of kibud av, honoring your father. So if we just look at the act, that is anything but honoring one's father, right? But it depends on context. So chok does not depend on context. It is any act we can look at, it's yay or nay, right? But a mishpat always depends on context, right? And the contexts are many, by the way. They're all over the map. And this is, I don't know if I'll have a chance to say it later on, but this is one time where it's just one example where it's imperative to have a rav, and you'd be very surprised what the halacha is in a number of different ways, a number of situations. You'd be very surprised. Things that you've learned is absolutely, no, you can't do this. You can't just go to a shir and hear, because remember, a shir is for public consumption. A book is for public consumption, right? A tshuva that's in response to you, your question on a one-on-one basis may have nothing to do with it, because there's a lot of other issues that are going on. So always, always ask a rav. And it's especially true for Balei Tshuva, because I think we always learn, as we learn this yes, this no, this yes. And then that kind of gets in there, that cerebral cortex there, and kind of like it's a yes and it's a no. You know, ask when the situation is the troubling situation.
I'm just moving over there. Might be
it's a little warmer. Yeah. Do you want my jacket?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a mishpat. Then we finally said that there's something called the mitzvah, right? The mitzvah is the obviously religious act, and we'll focus on prayer. And we said that prayer, in a sense, is like a chok, because there is a yes or no component. Praying is a positive thing, and not praying is a negative thing. However, there is another component that we haven't addressed yet, and that is, and it's best explained in looking at an unfortunate reality amongst people who've prayed for many years. If you have people who are friends who are from birth, or if you have friends who have been frum for many years, or if you yourself have davened, say, for, let's say, 5, 6, 7, 8 years or longer, you will recognize that slowly at some point, some or all of Shmoneh Esrei becomes memorized. And you feel, oh, great, I can finally, close my eyes and really focus, but it's a curse. Because once it's memorized, then your mind can easily travel. Not you, mine. My mind can easily travel. And, you can clearly go through an entire Shmoneh Esrei, back up 3 steps, say, I'm done already? I forgot that I began even. That's not the best way to daven.
You can do it in English, too.
It can even happen in English. It can happen in any language. Right, so, that's true. So that is an unfortunate reality. Now, therefore, the soul gains not only from the moving of the mouth and the words coming out. I mean, that's your yotzi b'di'evit, so to speak, meaning you don't get punished for not davening Shmoneh Esrei, right? You don't have to daven again. In fact, you can't daven again. It's another story. But Let's see, you know, Davin Shmon Esra, you finish, and then you go, oh my gosh, I wasn't focused whatsoever at all for the last 3 minutes. What do I do now? So the answer is you don't repeat it. But you certainly don't get credit. There's no reward for that Shmon Esra. Right? So why? Because there needs to be an emotional component of that. So part and parcel of most most mitzvahs, what we define as the religious, the prayer certainly, but is what we call in Hebrew kavana. But kavana means focusing, what am I saying? What does this mean? And to varying extents, different segments of orthodoxy will place tremendous focus on kavana. There are, for example, if you go to a Hasidic shul on Rosh Hashanah, and you interview the Baal Tekeya, the person who blows the shofar, he may have like specific Kabbalistic mindsets and what he was thinking when he blew, because that's part and parcel of the blowing of the shofar. So that's as an example. Okay. Those are all types of mitzvahs, and that's part of the natural science. And once we open the door of this, calling it a natural science, we should immediately have a number of questions, and I'll ask them for you. We've asked several already. One is, we learned that and not doing a mitzvah, let's say it that way, or doing something that we're not supposed to do, depends, or the punishment anyway, depends on whether it was done on purpose, whether it was done negligently, or whether it was an entirely accidental act, entirely unconscious of the act whatsoever. I tripped and, or, you know, yawned, stretched and turned on a light on Shabbos. It's just something, no consciousness whatsoever. So how does that work into the science? So we said that and this is real important, but the question always is, who am I? Who's making decisions? What's going on? I have a soul, I have a body. We all have a soul, we all have a body. And the answer is we're neither soul nor body, because we have the soul who always wants closeness to God, always wants the right thing. And we have a body who often doesn't. And so the decider will hopefully hear both voices and hopefully will go with the decision or the recommendation of the soul. Okay, that's the goal. Okay, it seems simple. So we know it's not so simple sometimes. But that decider is who we are. Okay, you are the person who decides in every moment of the day and everything, whether you say something, whether you should think something, whether you should do something. That's who we are. We decide. So therefore, if the decision is what feeds the soul, then how much of a decision is it when it's a purposeful decision? Well, that's the whole basket, right? So if we purposely decide to do an avera, then the onish, the punishment, is the doing of the avera. If, on the other hand, the doing of the avera is b'shogeg, is an accident, but it was a negligent accident. I didn't know that this was forbidden. I didn't know that this and this is not kosher. I didn't know that this heksher is not good. I didn't know that, you're supposed to say tachanun today. Whatever else it is, I didn't know that was the halacha. Okay? Or, I didn't know today was Rosh Chodesh. So that's why I didn't say, I didn't hear the announcement. I didn't see, look at my calendar. Right? So there, the decision is, I didn't know. That's the decision. So should we punish or not? Well, let's think about it. Should we have known? Could we have done anything else that we would have known? And the answer sometimes is yes, and the answer sometimes is no. And to the extent that it is possible for us to have known, I didn't know the area was down. Right? So to the extent that the answer was knowable, and we, as thinking persons who are worried about our soul, should be conscious of that, then maybe we should have made the extra phone call. Maybe we should have, checked the internet or whatever, however else we usually do it. Maybe we, should have taken an extra kashrus class and, read up with Rabbi Eisner, it's not Eisner, Eidlitz, right? Et cetera. So I'm not trying to make anyone feel guilty, but this is how it works. There's like, if somebody is, stopped and keeping Shabbos 3 weeks ago, there's a lot they don't know yet. And I can't imagine any human person would expect them to know everything. And I can't imagine the Almighty is more stringent than that. So as we learn more and more, then the question becomes, how humanly possible, reasonably humanly possible, was it for me to have encountered all the answers? Okay, so someone who went to yeshiva and studied in a kollel for 5 years, a lot is expected of that individual, knowledge-wise, a lot. The same cannot be said for people who were not fortunate enough to get that background, right?
What about the unconscious or the accidental? Right. Sometimes you get someplace and you're unconscious, or you flip a light switch by accident.
Right, so how much decision went into that? None, right? So therefore there's none.
No willful thought.
There's zero willful thought, so therefore there's zero effect on the soul. You don't have to do tshuva for that. You don't have to chat al chetz, you know. Mm-hmm. You don't have to bring it up at Yom Kippur, nothing. Because there was no willful thought. Okay? And it's not as if you could have known. You know, you can't say, I shouldn't have stretched my arms when I yawned. You know, that you understand that doesn't make sense. Okay. All right. Clear so far? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that was week one. We did that in 12 minutes. Pretty good. Okay. Week two, last week, there's going to be new material by then. Week two was all of the derabbanans, the rabbinical laws, because we know that rabbis make new laws. So the question is if halacha is a science of the soul, their natural laws, I guess you can ask it a couple of ways, but what gives the rights to the rabbis, you know, to make new ones, number one, and number two, because the answer to that one is the Torah does, but number two is, Even if the Torah does, couldn't God just have told us, you know, and figured out a way to say something like, you know, in the year 1887, electricity would be created. I think it was not that much for us. Anyway, and then at that point in time, you will not be able to turn on a light, or there will be such things as cars eventually, and you cannot drive them, right? Or et cetera, et cetera. Or, you know, the Torah was given at some point. There will be something called Purim, and these are the laws of Purim. You know, I wouldn't say it explicitly, but maybe there would have been a way. Sure, could have been a way. So how does that work? Well, number one, the Torah does require, in a number of different places, a couple different places anyway, the rabbis to make laws, to create laws when needed. Number two, we need that. Our souls need our leaders to make new laws and for us to follow our leaders. And there's two types of laws they make. One is called a gezerah, or a decree. But what a gezerah is a fence. Okay, so think of it as, and it's a good analysis, I think. If you have a little child with you, your own child, you're babysitting, it's your niece, what have you, and there's and you're at Palos Verdes, and there's a cliff that falls 100 feet to the rocks below. You don't want the niece to get right up to the cliff, okay? Whether or not there's a fence there, you don't want them to get anywhere near there, you know? It's just a little nerve-wracking, right? So you create, like, another extra border, okay? You know, see this line here? Not beyond this line. I don't even want you to think about over here. This is where we go. Right? So what happens when you do that? When the rabbis do that, they're not saying, God really wants you to stay here. God really, he said here, but he wants you to stay. No, he doesn't. God said, don't go past here, right? God said, this is false, this is true, and this is the line. Right? The rabbis are saying, you know what? Our soul, we all need to know that this is so delicate, this is so dangerous, that we're going to create this, like, artificial gray area. It's a different material. It's different altogether than this. It's forbidden territory, but it's not like this forbidden territory. This is like, this is death. Okay? This is like, you're not being careful. Okay? You're being a little sloppy. So, we want you to stay here. That's what a gezerah really is. And that's what a defense really is. And it has to be a different, you understand why it has to be a different material. Because if it was the same material, if like what the rabbi said is, you know what? We're going to actually move the cliff here. So we're going to dig all this out, and now this is the cliff. And then that's silly, because this is no different than this. Right? Okay, so this has to be a different material than this, because your understanding is this is death. This is like going, this, my soul is going purposely, it's pushing it in God's face. He says no, I say yes. You know? That's suicide. Okay, this is not suicide. This is the recognition that I need to be very careful, and I respect the fact that God has rules, and so therefore I'm going to be extra careful about the rules. Okay, that's a gezeirah.
Green light, orange light.
Yeah, kind of similar to that, right? Okay, we need extra rules to kind of like make sure we're safe. Then there is takana. Takana is from the same shorish, the same root as to be. Well, it's takana, it's fixing, right? Tikkun is to repair. Latakain is to repair. So to fix or to repair, it means they're repairing something. What are they repairing? They're repairing something that is not inherently broken, but evidently it's become broken. What does that mean? Well, again, let's look at prayer. There's many things in the Torah that were seemingly left purposefully vague. They're open-ended. We know that there's a halacha, but you can look at all the Torah-idic source material, and you won't find any specifics on it, because there were no specifics on it. Okay, so prayer is one of those examples. I think somebody asked, where's the source for prayer, and I didn't look it up yet. I'm just up in bed, okay? I think you asked, right, and I didn't look it up. Okay, did you get an answer?
Was that it?
You asked a couple questions, but somebody asked about that. So where is the source for prayer? I don't know. Actually, I did know once, I remember, but I forgot where it is, because I remember looking it up once, and I don't remember anymore. But there's a halacha for prayer. It doesn't say, we don't know how much, how often, what to say, when to say it, nothing like that. None of those are Torah-derived. Everything else is rabbinical. So what happened? The Torah understands that each and every single one of us is different. We each have different intellectual abilities. We each have different emotional abilities. You know, everyone's different in different ways, right? So some people relate very well to words. Some people don't relate very well to words. Some people just could just think and just feel, see colors, you know, and to them that's a very moving experience. And someone else, you put them in the same movie theater and it means nothing to them. Right? And you know people like that. They go to the planetarium and they go, wow, that was great. You know, well, nothing happened to me, right? So there's all kinds of people in that regard. So the Torah understands that there's different people, and we should each and every single one of them, of us, ideally, should know ourselves, know what the requirement should be and what it means to us, and act responsively and act accordingly. So one person would speak, you know, express themselves eloquently. One person would speak in poetry. And rhyme, perhaps. One person would just close their eyes and visualize. One person would do it for a minute. One person would do it for 10 minutes. One person would do it for an hour. One person would do it once a day. One person would do it 6 times a day. Right? I don't know if that happened. I'm not sure. I wasn't there. I don't have a record of it. But I can just imagine that must have happened, because there were no guidelines at all until the rabbis came around many, many, many years later. The Anshei Knesset Gedolah. So we're talking about after the Purim story, the very, very beginning of the Second Commonwealth, right? So that's what, 800, 900 years, 1,000 years or so after the Torah was given? That's a long time. And they said, here's the script. And not only that, I want you to do it 3 times a day, women twice a day, and the third time is optional, do it or don't do it, it's up to you. Okay? Actually, for men too, the third time was optional, but it was accepted by all men to do it, so it's become... We'll talk about custom. That's become a custom, but it's an accepted custom. That's Maariv. We'll talk about that in a moment. All right, so that's what a takana is. Other things are entire creations, because Purim, for example, is a takana, and Hanukkah is a takana. Those are holidays that were established by the rabbis. There was no Torah source for those. It couldn't be, because they can't. Well, they could be, but there wasn't. they found derivations of that in Torah. The rabbis are very clever about finding hints and thoughts and ideas, which I'm sure you may have heard in Torah, but in and of itself, no one claims that either of those holidays have a Torah-idic source. They're entirely rabbinical. So why do we need rabbinicals? Because our souls need to be told to listen, not to stray from their words, which is what the source of the halacha is. Do not stray from their words. And specifically, we need fences, because we need to be reminded that we have to be careful. And we need structure, because sometimes left to our own device, and this is what happened We don't really pay as much attention to our soul's needs as we do, and the rabbis come and rescue us. So we said, who are these rabbis? Who creates laws? Does every rabbi do that? No. We'll talk more about that a little later on today, but for today's session. But many of these were created actually by Moshe Rabbeinu. Some of Joshua created some. Shlomo HaMelech created many of them actually. But the vast majority are what we call the Ashkenazic Gedolah, which were the last of the people who actually had prophecy. After that, there was no prophecy. Which is not to say that people without prophecy couldn't make it, because for example, there were some, Rabbeinu Gershon, have you heard of Rabbeinu Gershon? Yeah? So Rabbeinu Gershon was about two or three generations before Rashi, or four generations before Rashi. So it was, an early Rishon. Right? And he lived in Germany, and he was the leader of Golis, of the Jewish world at the time. And he made several takanas that we live by to this day. Before then, for example, men would have multiple wives. It wasn't as fashionable then as it was certainly at the time of the Mishnah, and certainly before then, which was was a regular occurrence. With Rabbeinu Gershon, he made it so that women had to accept a get for a divorce to be enacted. Prior to that, a divorce could be had by forcing a woman. She didn't have to accept it. A man just had to give it, and by definition, that was done. So he said, no, a woman has to accept it. And there are others, but third one, it was an interesting one, that one couldn't open someone else's mail. So that was a rabbinical, creation. There was no law. There was nothing. He didn't say, yeah, I found this in the Torah. No one thought about it before but me. But no. He said, we need this because there are some problems going on in what I see, and therefore I will enact this. And after all is said and done, rabbinical law does not become law if after a one-year period the Jews don't accept it. So even if the rabbis, in their mercy and their desire to see the Jewish soul survive, enact laws for our benefits, if the majority of Jews don't, there'll always be somebody who doesn't, of course, but the majority of Jews don't accept it, it's negated. And there's been examples which we talked about. Okay, which brings us to this week. Because the last thing we need to talk about is custom. We know that there is minhag. How does custom fit into the science of all this natural law of the spiritual world? That's yet another level. Okay, it's not a rabbinical law. Okay, the rabbis don't make up. They don't say, "Let's start this custom." It comes into its own actually. So where does it come from? Where do we get? More importantly, where does the legitimacy for custom come from? So the first answer is that custom itself is a form of rabbinical. The fact that there should be custom and that it could be custom is rabbinical in nature. And that is that, and you've heard the verse because it's a song, it's a popular song. But in Proverbs, in Mishle, King Solomon says, Shema b'ni Musar avicha ve'al titosh toras imecha. Know the song? Shema b'ni, Shema b'ni. No, they don't. It used to be popular. Okay. Nothing. Okay. All right. Anyway, Shema b'ni, listen, my son, Musar avicha, to the Musar, which is, Musar generally means the ethical laws, ethical tenets, avicha, of your father, ve'al titosh, and do not discard, toras imecha, the laws, the Torah, that is taught to you by your mother. Okay? The Talmud says that Shlomo got this backwards. He strayed from the original scriptural language. He wrote this, okay? And whenever something is in the Bible, Proverbs is part of the Tanakh, right? It's part of the Bible. So there's prophecy that's involved in it. There's prophetic vision. The words are not like Moshe Rabbeinu's words, not like Torah's words, where every single word is God-given. These are Shlomo Melech's words, and he had a prophetic vision, and he wrote what he thought or how he felt. So the rabbi said in the Talmud that he got it backwards. Because why? Because Torah refers to wisdom, and that usually is associated with the masculine. Musar, which is ethics, is generally referred to in the feminine. So why did he not that he got it? They didn't say he got it wrong. He said that since he did it backwards, there's an extra message here. This is not just a straightforward thing, which is redundant. It's not like a nice song. It's more than that. So it means that at the bottom of Torah is also ethics. That's one hand. That ethics is not just nice thoughts. It means that it really is also Torah. But also it means that Torah Simecha, that's the Torah that comes naturally, almost from mother's milk. It's a different type of Torah. It's not the Torah of the mind, it's Torah of the heart. I'll explain. It's interesting that in several places in the Talmud, there's a very interesting expression. When the Talmud can't figure out what the answer is, you know, struggles to figure out what an answer is in a specific case that's being discussed. And ultimately, and it says, several places, it says, leave it to the Jews. Even though they are not prophets, they are the children of prophets. And it ends it there. Almost to say, we're going to give the Jews a free hand, let's see what they do with it. What that means is that on a subconscious level, how do we act subconsciously? On an individual level, it's psychology. But on a national level, if you want to talk about a national level and that nation is Israel, then there's something prophetic going on. In other words, there are times when an individual goes in a certain direction, okay? An individual strays, or perhaps a few people stray from something. But if an entire community, or entire segment of the Jewish people, or the entire Jewish people, go in a certain way, and it's not against halacha, it's just interesting, you know, it's like a path within halacha, then there's something more than coincidence going on there. It's much more than psychology going on there. Because built into the subconscious of the nation is an understanding of which way is up, so to speak. Like the knowing which way to go. Okay, which is to say that there's several implications of this. Number one is what's called the law of custom. Law of custom is when something becomes the Jewish way of doing something. And you can think of examples perhaps in your head, but it might be wearing clothes, for example. Standing up when you pray, and maybe where to face, how to, standing up, sitting down when you bench, when you give a prayer to your children, lecha dodi, you know, the customs. There's so many different customs in prayer and everything else. Shalom aleichem is a custom. Okay, whether you say Shalom Aleichem on holidays, or you don't say Shalom Aleichem, that's another. That's a sub custom. You know, so those are so all these things. When something becomes the Jewish way of doing something, there's something prophetic going on. God is speaking through the hearts of the Jewish nation, and that's what Torah Simecha is. That's a Torah that is the mother's Torah. Okay, so the Talmud is therefore stating a commandment, which is do not stray from custom. Right? But just like there's a rabbinical law, do not stray from their words, which is that's found in the Torah. Right? So there is this what this prophet this line in Proverbs is explained in the Talmud to mean, not in so many words, but it says do not stray from existing custom. If you're part of the Jewish nation and the Jewish nation has a custom, don't stray from that, number one. Number two, if you're part of a segment of the Jewish people, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, okay, for example, okay, which still exists today. Many, as we'll see as we explore this a little further, many segments or so-called segments don't really exist as well as they used to. There's a lot of travel, there's really no geographic customs as much as there were even 50 years ago. So we don't have, or 70 years ago, let's say, but we don't really have a lot of that anymore. Hasidim, you know, have their customs, for example, and that's true. So, but you can see, you can be a Vishnu Chassid in Los Angeles, you can be a Vishnu Chassid in New York, you can be a Vishnu Chassid in Israel. So that all is you know, do not stray from custom. Of course, all this is if the this should go without saying, but all of this is if the adopted custom is kosher. Okay, if it's not, then it's not prophecy. It's Yetzer Hara speaking. It's right. So this subsumes, of course, this assumes that we're talking about kosher custom. Okay, so that's custom. That's law. The law of custom. Then there's custom as a matter of law, which is different than that because. There is when we have decided as a community to make this our law. And this we see a lot in when an entire community elects it or decides that a certain leader is our leader, and whatever he says we're going to do. Okay? This is not exclusively, but this is found to a big extent in Hasidim, right? So he's our Rebbe, and whatever the Rebbe says, that's what I'm doing. Okay? If it goes on for generations, which at this point they certainly all do, right? They've gone through many generations, all the various sects, and that includes, you know, what hat the Rebbe wears, what socks he wears, does he wear knickers, right? If the socks are white, the socks are black, you know, all that counts. And that's custom, and that's embraced, and that's very, very important to them. Okay, and that includes everything. If they have a certain type of lulav, you know, if they have a pitzom, on their esrog, you know, that little pointy thing, then that is halacha for them. That's not halacha lamaisa, okay? The esrog does not have to have a pitum. But if the Rebbe says, you know, he starts doing it and everyone accepts it, that becomes a custom, and that has the din of almost a neder. That's like an acceptance of halacha to the extent of a neder. Like, I will do what he says, and I do it, you know? It's like, I'm doing the extra thing.
So it has a din... For sure of halacha and almost of another?
Yeah.
Now, is this the same thing as when, I guess in the like Litvak community, the non-Hasidic community, we didn't have a Rebbe per se, but we have a Gadol Ador that most people listen to his psalm. Like when we have Rebbe Moshe Feinstein, I don't even know who.
There really isn't as much. There are Gadoli Hador these days, but there's no equivalent to Rebbe Moshe. Yeah.
Okay. Well, when we have somebody like that who's just clearly a Gadol Ador, who's Psake halacha we listen to. Mm-hmm. Well, does that become custom in the same way?
We'll address that in just a moment. The answer is no. The short answer is no.
Okay.
Because even though there's a Gadol Hador, it hasn't for many, many years been universally accepted. Even 100 years ago it wasn't. So it wasn't, this is not just a new thing with modern twists, like the Chazon Ish or the Chaim Ozer or Grozinski, where they were the Gedolei Hador. There are many people who didn't hold by them. I'll give you an example, a very cute little example. We have enough time for it. Rav Dessler, you've heard of Rav Dessler? Right? The Rav Dessler, right? So I don't know if you heard, but Rav Carmel, who wrote Strive for Truth, he actually wrote Michtav Meliyahu. It was Rav Dessler's words, but Rav Dessler never wrote the book. Rav Carmel was his Talmud Muvchak. He was his closest Talmud, one of his two, maybe. But he was very, very close to him, and he took notes all the time. And I think it's when he passed away, but I'm not sure. But if you look at, for example, in Strive for Truth, a lot of it is dated. You know, this was said at this place on something 1941. 1942, right? So this is like class notes of Rabbi Carmel. He also did the translation of the Ramban, the big blue volumes. So he did a lot of good things. He was nifter. He just passed away this Rosh Hashanah, in fact. So, Baruch Dynamis. But that was very recently. So Rav Dessler, when he moved from England to Eretz Israel, and he became the Mashgiach of Ponovitch, okay? At the time he moved, this was right after the war, after World War II. So the Gadol Hador there, the Ponovitch is in Bnei Brak, and the Chazon Ish the Chazon Ish died in 1953. So he was there. He was the Gadol Ha'ir of the city anyway. And certainly, I think the Gadol accepted Gadol in Eretz Israel, but not in everything. His halachas were not accepted. So, for example, one more thing, that the wife of Rav Dessler, Mrs. Dessler, was, I think, the daughter of Chaim Ozer Grozinski, who was the Gadol Hador in Vilna. He was, which was the Voloshin. He was the last head of the Voloshin Yeshiva. He was the head of the Voloshin Yeshiva for 40 years. And he was an absolute genius. And people you know, recently, Simcha Wasserman, actually, who was died just, 15 years ago. So he met with him. So, I mean, he was, you know, people knew who he was. It was described by several people that he would write with two different hands, two different responses simultaneously at the same time. He would answer that because he was too busy, and he would have a conversation with someone else talking about a third thing. So things that we would say, it's impossible, you cannot do this. He could do it. So that's the Brzezinski, Rav Chaim Walser. Okay, so that his daughter, one of his daughters, married Rav Dessler. They moved to Israel, right? Their first Shabbos there, the whole story about how it happened, but I'll give you this is the short version. But their first Shabbos of Dessler brings in a new large Kiddush cup, and she said, "What's with a new Kiddush cup?" Probably not in those words, but what's with a new Kiddush cup? And he says, "You know, we're not in England any longer. We're now here. The Chazon Ish is the Gadol Ha'ir, and his custom, his law, his psak halacha is that one should have, and I forgot the exact measurements. You'll forgive me, but it's substantially larger than what we hold. It's larger than what Moshe Feinstein holds. It's larger than what Chaim Noya holds, and it's larger than the one they had." So she looked at him and she said, "You mean to tell me that my father's kos was not large enough for you?" Mm-hmm. Or something like that, or so, you know? And he says, "Oh, forgive me, you're right." Okay? So from that point in time, he would use the one they used in England. The very first Shabbos that his wife passed away, so one of his close Talmidim, I don't know if it was Rabbi Carmel or not, but one of his close Talmidim happened to be there. You know, it was obviously a very special relationship, the husband and wife, and then you have the lap level. So he gets the coast that they usually see, the smaller one, right? And so Rav Dessler says, "Could you please get me the other coast, the big one?" So he says, "Sure." So he gets the other one, and he asks him afterwards why. So Rav Dessler told him the story, and he said, "But now that my wife is not here, I want to hold like the Gadol Ha'ir." Okay? So that's a beautiful story about the relationship, the special relationship that he had and how he answered it. But also it means that he wants to hold like the local custom. And that's with regards to sizes. And you know, shiurim, there's all kinds of opinions on the shiur. But that you were saying Moshe Feinstein before, that's pretty much universally accepted in America. Okay, that what shiur is, what size is for the Kiddush cup, and, you know, it's 4-point-something ounces. And right. Okay, did you follow? I'm sorry.
Well,
not really.
Actually, it sounded like you contradicted what you first said, so I guess I'm a little bit confused. I thought you said that actually there are people that don't hold by Rav Feinstein, so I'm a little. And at the end, you said that.
Well, for this particular halacha, yes. He also, I mean, he said many things that people. Some people hold by. He said that you can make tea, for example, in a kli shlishi, which Rabbi Cohen does. Okay, that's against the Mishnah Berurah and it's against the Aruch HaShulchan. All right. So many, many people you'll see will not make, even though Rav Moshe said you can. Even people who love and generally will hold Rav Moshe on almost everything, but on this one they won't.
But the point is that it's different from having a Rebbe.
Right, the Rebbe says that's what you do. That's there's no other question to say. There's nothing to talk about. There is no halacha outside the Rebbe, you know. So that's how that works. And for better or for worse. And we'll talk about that later on in the history side. The next session we'll talk a lot about Hasidus, okay? Okay, so let's get back to this. I think we got a little off track, but that's okay. That's important. So we said that the laws of custom are, there's two different types, there's two different aspects of it, not types really, but there's two different dimensions perhaps. The other one, and we actually mentioned it just in passing here, is something called Los Yiskodedu, which you see in Devarim, Deuteronomy, and literally it means do not make bundles and bundles. Do not make many bundles. Meaning that one community should be homogenous. Now, unlike the first two things we talked about, we see very little of this anymore. It used to be very common because it used to be in Europe, you know, you go from one shtetl to another shtetl, you have different local customs. It's not just because it was a Rebbe. Even when Pesach wasn't Hasidus, okay, that way it was. Even if it was a Litvish community, okay, then the Rav of the town made the rules of the town, and these are the local customs of the town. Well, today, for a variety of reasons, one of which only is that we don't have the little shtetlach idea, but you know, you don't really see that at all anywhere. Israel, to a small extent, but not even really there, really nowhere else. I was going to say the one exception would be like Monroe, New York, because that's or New Square, New York. But that's really more a function of those are created cities by Hasidim, who you know. So that's a New Square is a Square Rebbe, right? And Monroe is the Satmar Rebbe, right? So those are so it's not a function of the fact that they're geographically unique. They're a function of that they're that Rebbe's you know world, okay. Kept getting back to Hasidus. So we don't have that anymore. We don't have that. So now we actually have this community is here, the Young Israel community is here, and the Ishtar community is here, and the Anshim community is here. And in one community, you have several different ways of doing things, and people come and go. And there's a couple of things you probably do need to be aware that we do still see. One of which is, we think it's Derech Eretz, but it's really an outgrowth of this. And that is that one should, like when one is visiting, either outside the city or another shul in the city, then the custom of the place becomes the custom that I have to practice, at least publicly. Okay? The simplest example.
When in Rome do as.
Excuse me?
When in Rome do
as. Yeah, kind of like that. But, you know, obviously these are all kosher halachas we're talking about. These are different customs of, and the usual situation is the nusach of how you say that Shemon Esra, Tefillah, whatever else it is. So you shouldn't go out of your way to be different in a shul. And there are some exceptions to this, but generally speaking, when you're saying Shemon Esra, if you're by yourself, unless you're doing it publicly from the this wouldn't be for the ladies, but if you're doing it publicly from the Amud. Right? Then you're saying it quietly. So you can say your own version of it. That's not a problem whatsoever. But let's say you have Yortzeit, right? And you happen to be, let's say I daven Nusach Ashkenaz, I don't daven Nusach Sfard. But I happen to be, because I wake up at a certain time, or I happen to be visiting another city, and that's the only place is a place where they daven Nusach Sfard. So I said, excuse me, I have a chiyuv, it's my Yortzeit. Can I daven from the Amud? The answer is yes. I have to daven Nusach Sfard. I have to daven Nusach Sfard. Because that's the community standard. And this counts for everything. It's like if I'm leaning from the Torah, whatever else they do, I have to, I mean, I don't have to use their accent. If they have like an interesting accent, I can use my own accent. But the order of the tefillah, the words that they say, I have to do that. That's one example of that. When you're at someone's house, for example, some people you'll know will stand up during Kiddush, will sit down during Kiddush. So even, and some people will they have a custom, I don't know if you've been in places where everyone makes their own Kiddush, right? They'll give you a Kiddush cup, right? So one place I know, everyone, they get two loaves. Interesting. They make a lot of loaves. But everyone gets two loaves, right? So there's different customs. So again, when in Rome, right? So that's the custom of if you don't feel comfortable making your own Kiddush, it's fine, it's acceptable. But if they stand up, you stand up, if you know, so on and so forth. Okay? So that's still part of Los Yisko to do. There's one other example you may see, and that is on Chol HaMoed, there's a raging controversy on whether we put on tefillin or we don't put on tefillin, mm-hmm. right? So ultimately, it used to be geographically based, but now it's not. So now what most people do is they have since very few women, if any, come to Chol HaMoed davening, except when if you ever go away for Pesach, go to a hotel. So what most places do is they'll use the women's section of the mechitza for the wearers or the non-wearers, and vice versa. The other side, the minig of the shul, is the front section, and then the other section is the other minig. Okay, so they'll allow the other minhag to happen because it's a strong one, but they'll at least make believe it's two different shuls, like in other words, behind the mechitza, or on the other side of the mechitza. Okay, so those are a little bit of outgrowths that are worth knowing. Okay, and finally, how does plurality fit into this? I mean, there are so many opinions, as we've mentioned, as we've gone along. How can there be so many opinions if there is a natural law And, you know, how can everybody be right, right? As, and asking another question within that, you know, if are you a better Jew if you're more stringent than the next guy? If you hear a chumrah of the day, right? So today is chumrah, folks. Chumrah, you don't know the word? Okay.
No.
Chumrah is a stringency. Chomer, okay, is something to be, like, difficult. Okay, so is a stringency. Something like, you know, there's multiple opinions, you can do this. Oh, I want to be the most stringent opinion. So does that make us a better Jew necessarily? So that's a question that needs to be asked. And finally, you know, who is a kosher Orthodox rabbi? And as we mentioned, fortunately I did mention earlier, you know, who is your rabbi? So all that is important. You know that at Mount Sinai the Torah was given. Moshe got the Torah. Okay. There's a midrash. It's a very cute midrash. It's Moshe went to get the Torah. The angels argued. They said, how can you give... They argued with God. They argued with God. They said, how can you give the Torah to man? You know, man is clumsy, makes mistakes. Look, you know, Torah is pristine. It's beautiful. Perfect. Perfection. How can you do this? How can you give perfection to animals, you know, which is relative angels, right? And actually what they're saying, so they tried to stop Moshe Rabbeinu from grabbing it. So Moshe was very concerned. He says, what do I do? So God says to Moshe, hold my throne of glory and answer them. So he put his hand on God's throne of glory and he says to them, look at the Torah. Look at what it says. It says, honor your father and mother. Who's your father and mother? Angels. You know, and it's all kinds of laws in there that clearly don't affect you. Don't, you know, don't charge interest. What are you going to charge interest to one another? You don't have money. So the whole Torah is obviously not written for angels. And the angels were happy with the answer, and each of them gave Moshe a crown. Very sweet. Okay, so what does it mean? We learned already, we said, right, Midrash, did it happen, didn't it happen? What's the answer? Not a good question. Right? It's not a question. Right? It's not relevant to us whether it happened or didn't happen. That's not the point of Midrash. Okay, so what's the message? The message is very profound. The message is that when Torah was given, it was given, and it was meant to be here. And it's almost as if the upper world has nothing to do with it anymore. It did before. It was created there, but there was a transference of the Torah and all of its realms here, in this world, for better or worse, that's now the reality. So as a result, you know what becomes law? What is law? What is Torah? How we interpret the Torah. That is now law. Law becomes how the Jewish people, the leaders of the Jewish people, interpret the Torah for each and every situation, whether it's right or wrong, in whatever that means. Because what is right ultimately means how we, the Jewish people, interpret what is right. Not me and you. I mean, you know, the leading people, the big people, the people who know the stuff. So the Rambam, in the beginning of Hilchos Deos, says that no two people are alike. That's a halacha. There's no two people that are alike. Each one of us thinks differently, right? And so therefore, theoretically, every single Jew, like we kind of alluded this before when we were talking about why the rabbis came and made takanas, but every single Jew should know all of Torah, all of it, not just Torah the book, but I mean all aspects of halacha, all the books here, all of this. We should all know all of this very, very well, enough to know how we should react in every single situation. But unfortunately, there are very, very few people who we can say that of anymore. Okay, and it wasn't always like that. In the time of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, Chizkiyahu HaMelech was one of the last kings of Judea, Yehuda, before the Babylonian Empire. And so we're talking, about 580, 590, 600 before the Common Era. So they did a survey during his time. I don't know exactly, I forgot my Tanakh, but there was a reason that he wanted to know. So they went around and asked everybody, and they found out that every man, woman, and child, I assume it meant slightly older children, I don't think it means babies and stuff, but every man, woman, and child knew everything, knew all of Tanakh, all of Torah, all of Halacha. There was no Shulchan Aruch, but everything there was to know. All the Masorah. So it was pretty impressive. That was, you know, that was a high point. Now it doesn't happen. It's going to be a handful of people. But we do see that, I mean, Moshe, we talked about Moshe Feinstein. But Moshe was, before he was like 7 or 8 years old, 9 years old, he already knew Bava Basra, Bava Kama, and Bava Metzia inside out. He knew Rashi, every Rashi in Tosfos. That's unbelievable. And that's, you know, about 100 years ago. It's not ancient history. He only died 20 years ago. You know, this is a man of our times. A man who was alive when we were, you know, when we were younger. So it is possible. And there are people, I Reb Noach Weinberg, when he was a bacher, you know, there are stories where he would stand up with his feet in ice so he wouldn't fall asleep, you know, because when you sit down you get tired, and when you're warm you get tired. So he would turn they probably didn't have good air conditioners like this. So they put air, you know, he put buckets of ice, stood up like this so he wouldn't fall asleep, and he was up for 20 to 22 hours a day learning. So, you know, it is, I guess it's possible for some people to reach these heights.
Is it possible to have the air turned off?
Myself. Well, the good news is we're almost done.
No, but I mean
in the future.
Yeah, it's never been this chilly. I don't know why it's never, in fact, I've complained that it's hot, but so it's never been this chilly. So number one of what it takes to be an authority is enough diligence and enough stick-to-itiveness and enough inherent intelligence. That's both. You know, you can't just have raw intelligence and not do anything with it, and you can't just sit and learn for 20 hours a day and not be exceptionally smart. It takes both, and so to master all this stuff. And that's one. But the other part's harder. And the other part is to be absolutely objective in giving answers. And it's much harder. It means you got to take yourself out of it altogether. You know, you have to give. And even though when you're answering another person's question, you take the situation in part, but you can't let emotion or compassion play too part of a role, too strong of a role. There has to be the answer that's the correct answer. So there has to be an objective answer. You know, there's a difference. You can take all the factors into account and then look very hard to find an answer that's fitting and think very hard for an answer that's fitting. And that's what it means to be a Rav. That's what it means to be a Posek. That's what it means. So that's, I mean, really we should all be at that level. That's what the Torah really wanted. It's not that it's unfair. It is fair. So it put it there for all of us. But unfortunately, we didn't do our jobs as well as we could have. Or, you know, I guess it's still possible in theory. Okay? So that's what a Rav is. So those are the two ingredients. So when you find a Rav, obviously those are the two ingredients you're looking for. Now I think most of you have a Rav already, and that's a good thing. All right. So that's really the end of the science of the soul part of the course. Okay. I hope I've answered some thoughts and ideas and concerns and weird issues that, you know, like not weird issues, but like what weird questions that we all have. We all have these questions. How does this work? How does that work? And so yeah, they all work. They all are different examples, but there are places and times for all of this, and two opinions can be correct because there are customs in the world, and we're supposed to follow, you know, the customs that our forefathers or our fathers gave us. Okay, no class next week. Okay, and I will be able to call all of you. The following week we'll begin the last 3 weeks session, which is an overview of the history of Masorah, how it actually step by step, you know, and how it actually went from place to place. At the end we'll get to modern history, which is I think sometimes most interesting and also most difficult to teach because it's really not history yet, you know. So, but we'll talk about, you know, the last 50 to 60 years and you know, where Reb Moshe fit in and why we hold like him, we don't hold by him, you know, someone like that. But there are, you know, there are answers that he gave that no one holds by, even though he was the most respected by far. He was absolutely the most respected posek in America, certainly by American, probably in the world, at the time that he lived. I mean, for example, when he lived, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was, you know, nothing yet, relatively speaking. And as soon as he died, then he was, you know, Shlomo Zalman became the number one guy. You know, he was that respected. And yet, there are a number of places where he gave a tshuva. People don't understand how he came up with the answer, and, you know, given who he was. And don't hold by him. Eruv, for example, was one of them. For example, one of the Eruv tshuvas that he gave, and other things as well. Okay, so I gave you the one about the tea. There's others as well. The Hall of Israel. But many people don't hold by the Hall of Israel Kula. They all give various reasons that he was doing it because at the time it was hard to get Hall of Israel and people were going broke and they couldn't afford the Hall of Israel. That's one example, one issue. But many people hold by the Kula. Many people don't. The yeshiva world is not. You know, if you go to Lakewood, you won't find people buying regular milk, for example. You know, not the city of Lakewood I'm talking about. The yeshiva for sure will not, but even the whole city of Lakewood will not. So that's another example where it was not accepted by everybody. Okay? That's it. Any questions before we all freeze?
Well, I do have a question, though.
Okay.
This could be able to be answered here right now. It's time to go.
Do you want to see if there's a Marv?
Wait, I did Marv.
Oh, you did Marv? Oh.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Why I know that.
Go ahead, please.
No, I'll go ahead this out of town. I just want to see if they're davening or not. I don't see cars pulling in, so I'm, you know.
Yeah.
No, I'm easy.
I see people coming in, so it could be. You want to go check real quick?
Okay, just to see if there is. Let me just see.
Hold on.